listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and everything that's going on in our entire environment that sustains and supports versus undermines and hurts living beings, animals, people, food, water, air, and earth, communities, and society, and the earth that carries, nurtures, and sustains us all. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, and each week on the show, we talk with different people who bring in different perspectives, visions, and insights into key areas that are impacting all of us, part of the conversation about protecting ourselves, living beings, and the earth. I talk with scientists, journalists, advocates, activists, authors, poets, thought leaders, filmmakers, psychologists. We've just had so many different kinds of people on the show. We have a wonderful returning guest today. And I also urge all listeners to go into Connect the Dots Podbeam and dip into our archive. If after you've enjoyed today's show, you want to share it with a friend, that's where you can go for show links so more people can participate and hear our show today on Connect the Dots. With me today is Dina Metzger, who has been on the show before, I think once or twice at least. She is a poet, a writer, an environmentalist, an advocate for the earth, and a deep ecologist and transformer of our ground of understanding for perceiving where we are and finding new resources for addressing our current dilemmas. So Dina has written a new book, and we're going to be discussing that on today's show, which is very exciting. And actually, I just have to say, I personally owe Dina a lot of gratitude because I have had longstanding connections to Native peoples and land that didn't really fully come into my clear awareness about the meaning of that, both in my own life and for the reporting and sharing and everything that I do in our world until my connection with Dina emerged. So I just want to, and that was like, I don't know, five or seven, or it seems like forever, but it was it's been a while, so I just, before we begin, I just want to acknowledge and express tremendous thanks about that. Dina's new book, just published, is called A Reign of Nightbirds, and there's a lot about issues that have been dear to all our hearts and very amply featured on this program concerning environmental, the environment, pipelines, and Native spirit and wisdom in modeling for us how to protect the sources of life, really. So welcome back to Connect the Dots, Dina Metzger.
Oh, thank you so much, Allison. What a beautiful introduction. And yes, we have absolutely known each other forever because the moment we met, we knew that we were of a common mind in saving the earth.
Yes.
And that's where our hearts are.
That is exactly right. And, we've had a tremendous year, a horrific year in some, in many aspects, but also an amazing year of Indigenous uprising with Standing Rock. And I would love to talk about that and out of that discussion talk about your book. because, you know, I've covered Standing Rock as much as possible on this program with people who have come from there, photographed there, filmmakers from there, all kinds of people who've been there, and now you, a writer, poet, and environmentalist who, you know, in the, how shall I say this without using horrible cliches, but in the elder time of life have gone there to lend your participation and voice. And so if we had been having this conversation, which, of course, we have had these conversations a year ago, 5 years ago, it would have been a different conversation because the awareness of indigenous wisdom and the role of the indigenous in all that we who are awake and caring are looking to and doing has really broadened out and reached out and interconnected so many more people because of Standing Rock and all that went on there. And so for any listeners who are not familiar with Standing Rock, we'll be kind of unpacking a little bit about what it is as we discuss it. Dina, you know, I'd love to hear your, you know, an account of your own responses when you became aware of Standing Rock and were called to go there.
Well, from the beginning, when I learned about Standing Rock, I knew that I had to go there. And it came to my consciousness primarily because I live on a sort of feral or almost wild land, as you know, and I have a landmate, an incredible friend and woman who also lives on the land. Her name is Cheryl Potts, and she is Aleutic and from Kodiak Island in Alaska. And when Standing Rock began, from the very, very, very beginning, she was following it. And my first response was that I had to find the means for Cheryl to go to Standing Rock. It was not so important for me, but it was important for her as a Native woman to be able to be there with the people who are holding the consciousness of this time. And, you know, I sort of remember Daniel Berrigan saying in the Vietnam War, he said, don't just do something, stand there. And so standing there, standing with, has been a very important idea in my mind, that somehow our actions can distract us from what we must do, because when you're standing there, you are someone else. There is a commitment in standing there, and that's what mattered to me. So various things happened that connected us with Standing Rock. And then as winter approached, I knew no matter what, I had to bring her there. And so we did it. We just looked at calendars, and then we put a notice out to the community saying that we were going, and anyone who wanted to join us was more than welcome. But we also wanted to be able to bring some resources. And that felt very important, that we commit ourselves to being with the people who are creating the most amazing statement of what was important that we have seen. I don't know if we've ever seen this in our country, because what the Native people at Standing Rock did was to bring together activism with the deepest spiritual awareness and alliance. And they were and have continued to teach us the necessity of prayer and ceremony, because it is that deep connection with spirit and the land, which creates a way of living. And it is the loss of that connection and the attack on that connection by the conquest, by colonialism, that has created the horror that we are now in. So Standing Rock was an action. It's a continuing action. It is a ceremony, and it is a way of being. It is a mind of great beauty. And that's what I felt I might see when we went, and that's what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I was able to stand.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you know that that beautiful poster, or one of the beautiful posters of Standing Rock, we made up a very huge poster, cloth poster, that's now on my fence as you come into the property, as you come onto the land. And the idea is that Standing Rock is everywhere. We have to stand with Standing Rock everywhere if we are going to save life. And we came into Standing Rock with the first blizzard. And that felt very, very important. We flew into Bismarck, and we could not get to Standing Rock that day, and had to wait for the next day, and caravans, because it was so icy and treacherous. And I wanted, even for a moment, to share some of the circumstances that that the people at Standing Rock were enduring. And it was as if the weather said, okay, be real, you know. This is not an exotic experience. This is not a vacation that you're going on. This, you must know what some of these circumstances are in order to really meet it.
Yeah, these were circumstances that required tremendous endurance, courage, heart, commitment, faith in some greater force of connection and interconnection that, you know, just solidarity with one another. I mean, these, you know, this, it's... On the one hand, there's this harshness of the weather, to which the native people there are accustomed to that, but of the police actions, of
right.
the actions of the state, of the brutality and the cruelty, and the, I mean, to say it's anti-democratic is, it's so far beyond anything in a democracy that it, you know, that one would construe as being in any kind of democratic process or foundation, as to be, you know, almost unspeakable. And yet the people there were sustained and are sustained and continue to be sustained by their devotion to the earth, to endure and face, and willingly face and walk toward conditions and activities and people that, you know, anyone's adrenaline pathways would be telling them to run the other way. And
well,
they go
have,
forward.
Mm-hmm. They have survived and sustained and endured the most horrific conditions, 525 years of assault on wisdom and the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And now at this critical time, at this most critical time in human history, they are coming forth and saying, no, this cannot continue this way. And it felt to me when I was there that everything that I had experienced and read and thought about in terms of indigenous wisdom was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was true. And these people, have maintained a way of seeing, a way of understanding that
mm-hmm.
was assaulted from the beginning of the conquest,
mm-hmm.
from the beginning of colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Standing Rock also offers and insists upon is self-scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
By Western culture or non-Indigenous culture or the non-Indigenous culture that has taken over this land.
Yep. You know, it's funny, Dina, because I, without a doubt, had my own awareness of that kind of scrutiny dawn in some of the times that I have attended sweat lodges, which you first introduced me to, as well as in interchanges that we've had and time that we've spent and everything. But I also have had longstanding prior connection,
right,
to a tribe and tribal lands. This has been, you know, a feature of my life that I didn't even recognize as significant or have any clue about what it meant for most of my life until, you know, I'd say the last 10 years. And I was just speaking with, I tried to tell somebody what that self-scrutiny feels like. And the person naturally took it within the framework of familiarity to herself, which was, you know, a sort of Western psychotherapeutic model of, you know, oh, well, don't be self-critical and this and that. And then within a short amount of time, someone called who also has been spending important time with Indigenous people, and we had a whole conversation about how it's a simultaneous process of learning so much more than you ever knew while also looking at, you know, your own longstanding confusion and ignorance and being called to transform and to shift and to commit in different ways that where we have, in our habitual patterns, in the Western mind, so many outs, you know, so many rights and privileges and expectations of happiness and all kinds of things that are like prerequisites for any self-inquiry. And it is such a different experience, and it's a simultaneous experience. And sometimes it's joyful, and sometimes it's also you know, it breaks you open. So love to hear your thoughts on that process.
Well, I'm thinking about, I think I want to start off saying, because it feels really important, that I am not by blood or lineage an Indigenous person.
Right.
And that I came to this because I have been heartbroken about the world. And I have been asking myself continuously and asking everyone and everything that I meet, how did we get to this place? What aspects of mind have brought us to this horrific place of violence against the earth and each other and all beings?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started a process of self-scrutiny and of cultural scrutiny. And nothing matters to me but changing our minds so that we can live in ways that restore and uphold the beauty of creation. Mm-hmm. So in my experience with indigenous peoples and their ways of thinking and their ways of living, I began to see that there was ingrained in the way non-indigenous people think certain ideas that are leading directly to the situation that we're in. And so it seems clear to me that we must change our minds. And that's what I've been writing about and thinking about and teaching for many, 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 many years in so many for my entire life, I have been asking the question, how did we get to this place that we are at in the world? How did we get to this place of violence against each other, against the earth, against all beings? And I kept asking that question. I asked the question when I was, 9 years old, and I learned about the bomb. And my instinct was to ask, how did we become a people that would drop that bomb, that would create that bomb?
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, when I learned about the camps and what happened to my people in the Holocaust, I asked, mm-hmm. how did we become a species that would do that? I understood from the time I was a child that the behaviors of war that have become prevalent are unnatural. And psychotic, really.
Mm-hmm.
There's something terribly wrong with our minds. And I wanted to find out what was causing this and where was the medicine. And it became clear to me that we needed to change our minds so that the earth could survive. And I certainly learned that when I had breast cancer in 77. And I realized that cancer was an imperial force that took over a landscape and destroyed everything. And it was the way we were living in the world. It was imperialism. And so when I had the fortune in my life to be connected in various ways with indigenous peoples in Africa and Latin America and here in the United States, I became aware of ways of thinking that are different from non-indigenous imperial minds. And what became the essence of it for me is of a simple and constant phrase in the Lakota way, which is Mitakia Yasin, all my relations. And to be of a people or of a mind that sees the world in terms of relationship with all beings and with the earth itself, rather than an individual in conflict and endangered by or competing with, that was the essential difference. And so, you know, the book comes out of the book comes out of this anguish. The book arises.
The book, The Reign of Nightbirds?
A Reign of Nightbirds, this novel that I have just published. And this novel that was really given to me to write. It is about two climatologists, a non-Indigenous woman and an Indigenous man, both climatologists, who know what is happening to the Earth and are trying to find the ways to live, given what they know. And we watch their minds change as they come closer and closer to the Indigenous knowledge that he was born into, but she was not. And what I just realized about the book is because they form a relationship of a non-Indigenous woman and an Indigenous man, they feel the pain of the world in a deeper way.
Mm-hmm.
Because as climatologists, they're in relationship. They can't escape the pain of it. But they also can't escape the beauty. And what I've realized now that I did not know was that the book is saying that this relationship in consciousness between non-Indigenous people and Indigenous people can make an incredible difference. I didn't get it till this moment about the fact of their loving each other is, in essence, part of what we're being given. So if you have the conquest 500 years since 1492, that was a war against a consciousness that understood the value of the earth and connection. And these two people come into connection. The book is really about relationship.
That's amazing.
And
it's really incredible.
There were actually four characters in the book: Sandra Birdswell and her father.
I missed that last part. We'll have to start that again because I didn't. That we had a blackout there. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There are four characters in the book: Sandra Birdswell, who is a climatologist; her father, who is a country doc, but spent 2 years on the Four Corners Reservation as a physician rather than going to Vietnam; and his dear friend, who is a younger elder, let's say. He has the role of an elder and a medicine person, though he is still a young man on the reservation. And then Terrence Green, who is the chair of the climatology department. And Sandra and Terrence form a profound bond. And then the four of them are bonded. And it didn't occur to me in this moment that this book, which I think I just brought through, this book was not my idea. This book was given and insisted upon, that it is about relationship is the healing and the necessity. And of course it is the medicine for a situation in which we have destroyed relationship and acted violently against Indigenous people in this country and everywhere on the planet. And so it behooves every non-Indigenous person to participate in that act of self-scrutiny and take responsibility for it and change and find ways inside our hearts and minds to create relationship and make amends.
And make what? Make amends.
And make amends. So the psychologists who say, oh, don't take this to heart, or, you know, don't enter into this painful way of looking at self. That's completely wrong. And actually, it is psychology which becomes so narcissistic.
Yes.
So focused on the individual. That
right.
is part of the problem that we are in.
Yep.
Right.
And it's so strongly conditioned, you know, that, and it's like, it's kind of like we celebrate and make a almost fetish out of, you know, coming through one's life familial story, you know, to a place of self-recognition and greater wholeness. But then it's as if the rest of adult life with its engagement with caring for community in the world is we never progress to that, because it's, you know, we're looking, you know, we're restoring an individual all the time as,
well,
you know,
you're restoring an individual and maintaining his and her amputation from everything that matters.
Really?
And so, you know, I'm not trying to idealize other people, but if you look at indigenous ways of thinking everywhere on the planet, that which we can still see that hasn't been distorted by our imperial cancer, you will see people who think in terms of relationship. So there's no evolving if you're not in relationship. There is only the recognition of who you are in relationship to everything else. And it is the everything else and the health of everything else that matters.
I mean, you know, my journey is that I began reporting on, you know, the most natural ways to move toward and support individual health. And, you know, which is the whole self-help, integrative health movement. And
yes.
then, but we're not, you know, self-contained robots in a space capsule. We are completely dependent upon and one with and interactive with and belong to the earth and our place in it and the environment and all of that. And the minute you cross that boundary and see, you don't perceive that. And I actually think that I came to this understanding and have been, you know, a proponent of it and educating about it and teaching it, because I most needed to learn it as a very, you know, mental and intellectual kind of, you know, not the world's most visceral person. I'm not out there, you know, climbing mountains and hiking or anything like that. I'm a very unlikely draftee, you know, because I needed it so much and still do, you know. So, I mean, and, you know, so then I feel lucky. I feel really fortunate, but it is, you know, but it isn't that reassuring thing of, you know, celebrate me and now I'm whole or whatever. It's, you know, it's, you know, we're in a tumultuous time and we can't retreat from it. We can retreat to self-restore, but one can't retreat indefinitely because...
I don't think we can retreat from it.
No.
Nope. We are in a tumultuous time. We are all suffering it. And the way we think is not going to heal us.
Mm-hmm.
And... I suppose that's the exploration of the book, that it is looking for understanding different ways of thinking so that healing can occur.
Mm.
Or at least that we not do more harm. And, you know, my work with people with... serious illness. I'm always asking the question, you know, how does this illness relate to the illness in the society?
Mm-hmm.
Not what did the individual do that caused the illness? Not mm-hmm. what's wrong with the individual. What is wrong with the milieu in which we're living and the way we're living from which this illness emerges, so that any act of healing goes all the way through the layers? Can I bring healing to myself in a way that is also healing to my community and healing to the earth?
That's a really amazing question to to sit with and resonate with, you know, on all of these, on all of this. You know, I have to share an experience in this regard because as someone who reports on health and healing methods all the time, I'm, you know, constantly interacting and people who are suffering in various ways. You know, I'm always in that field and interacting with that.
Yes.
And yesterday I went through a course of treatments for natural treatments for an acute insect bite that could potentially have led to Lyme disease, and it basically was very clearing, which I felt really delighted by. Which doesn't mean that I'm, you know, perfect in every way, but this was something, you know, that I was able to call upon the herbs of the earth to help address. And then, and this was just basically for 2 months and ending maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. Then yesterday I returned from a walk outside and I had two bites. On my knee. And I could see, and I got the insects and put them in a jar, and, you know, to preserve what they were and who they were and all of that. And I saw the beginning of the swelling, and I had, and I was like, oh, no, go
right
through this all over again. I won't have a microbiome left. You know, it'll be sort of challenged by all of this. And then I realized that 4 days prior, I had been in a place of, like a healing place that I go to where they offer different services and sell different products, and I had been drawn to a particular product, and that particular product was just the right thing to apply to draw out the toxins. That was my instinct, was to apply this thing, which I had only gotten 4 days earlier, and make a poultice out of it, which I did. It was a tooth powder, but it made of earth and some herbs, but it worked really well for this purpose, and it just drew it all out until it was gone. I mean, I couldn't see it. It was no bite, no inflammation, no nothing. The insects had already been removed. It, like, sucked it out, washed it down through the water. And so, you know, There it is, the earth and the water.
And they are in relationship with you, and you with
yes.
them.
Yes.
And maybe we can say that this is the reciprocity that you spend your life trying to protect the plant people and the earth, and they came forward. And
they did, and I wouldn't have noticed them had this situation, you know, had I not been, had the insect world not, you know, drawn this to my attention.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it feels very important, Allison, that when we think about healing, that we not... we not just think about healing ourselves.
Right.
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 So what is the reciprocity? If our life is just part of many, many, many other lives which thrive when they are in relationship and do not thrive when they're isolated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wisdom that came from the deep ecology movement, from Joanna Macy and the thinkers she was associated with, that the world will survive in its complexity, but it will not survive if we keep killing off the elements. So we have to live in an interactive world in order for life to continue.
Yeah. And that's really, so that's a, you know, that's, it's, you know, we've kind of, when you speak of the mind, it's, you know, I resonate with that, and it's also a certain kind of mind, but it's also that we have hardened our, the forms that, you know, we've accepted hardened forms of belief that contain our minds and our understandings.
Right.
We've accepted those hardened shapes as being true and immutable when, in fact, they are not. They are, you know, destructive. They are fragile. And so it's also that, and this is just my experience, we have to also accept a certain fluidity of understanding and ways of being to allow some change to happen, and that in and of its, and I, and this is where I think also Indigenous mind is more accustomed through community, you know, holding and belief to that fluidity than we are as Westerners. So it can really. And you need something that is holding and something that is fluid for that, you know, both for that to for those kinds of transformations to happen. And so otherwise they feel very threatened, and people then cling to the rigidified form as their only
right.
option, you know.
And so they continue the isolation and the disconnection, which is at the core of what they're suffering.
Yes.
You know, I'm thinking, if I may say this, of the time that that we met, and you were in a desperate state, and what we were doing at that moment was we were going to a sweat lodge.
That's right.
And it wasn't like, oh, I have this medicine. You're in a desperate state. Let's take this remedy.
Mm-hmm.
But it did happen that
mm-hmm.
we met and we went to a sweat lodge.
That's exactly right.
And it's not like taking a pill, but that made an enormous difference. And then
yes.
we sat in community. And
yes.
that made an enormous difference.
Yes, that's it.
And
that's right.
Community heals.
Yep. Yep. Yes, it's true. And it's...
And
it is
community
true.
Heals, and we have to heal community.
Yeah, that's really, oh my God, it's so funny that you say that. Because, you know, I have been obviously, you know, writing and a journalist and in the radio show and social media and putting forth, but I am also feeling very called more to do, you know, that direct community, working with, dealing with, helping, futzing over things with people directly in person, in groups, in places, in systems and stuff like that. I've begun feeling called to step down off away from the beautiful, pristine computer with my own, you know, understandings and those that I derive from that mental realm to do that and do more of that. So because it just seems like, I mean, my own feeling for this time is that we also all need much more listening. We need to listen more.
Yes.
And understand, you know, what, how we're feeling and what part of us is speaking so that we can be discerning about how we engage to heal divisions. That's, you know, I've been fretting over that.
Well, it's part of standing there. You're not standing there if you're with your computer.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You're standing there in the morning before the light is up and it's
mm-hmm.
freezing cold and there's a circle forming of people and there's a sacred fire and an elder singing the prayers and women coming holding copper cups with precious water that they're blessing. And then you take this water down to the river and you bless the water and you bless the river and you are suddenly in a way of life that makes absolute sense. Every aspect of it makes sense. And from that way of being, you know what to do. But when you're standing in front of your computer or sitting in front of the computer, you don't know what to do. We don't know what to do.
Right. That's right.
We're bombarded by information and events that overwhelm us. They're not connected. They're not in a relationship. It's not an ecology. It's just a bombardment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference. You know, I don't know. I feel called to reading some words from the very first, from the preface of this book.
Yes, please. I was just thinking of the title of the book and wanting to mention again, we're talking with Dina Metzger and about Standing Rock and about her new book, A Rain of Nightbirds. What, you know, I'd love to have you read, please.
So this is the preface, the mystery. The book began when I heard a voice speaking to me. The voice identified a character by name and occupation. You know, the voice began. I shuddered. I didn't know. And hearing a voice speaking so clearly and precisely overwhelmed me. It was not what the voice said. It was that there was a voice speaking to me, a voice that was real, coherent, and external. And this, Allison, is about listening and what that really means. It was February 2011. Walking in Joshua Tree National Park, I found myself preoccupied by picking up garbage until my pockets and hands were full, and yet there was no end to it. I had just published another novel, and I was hoping to be inspired to write the next. I'm sorry. The word surprised me. I had said them aloud. I'm sorry, I repeated, holding the garbage in my hands. That's when I heard the voice. You know, the voice said, her name is Sandra Birdswell, and she is a meteorologist. The voice spoke with authority. I couldn't dismiss it. Authority and insistence. I had been longing for a novel, and now it was being given to me, so I could not refuse. Even though I knew nothing about the character, I had no choice but to accept the challenge that would take me far beyond myself. I did not understand where I was being led, but I had to commit myself and write what was called for. At that moment of the book's inception and Joshua Tree, Terence Green didn't exist. Then a year later, he came to me. To me, as the writer, Terence Green is a greater mystery than Sandra Birdswell, who introduced him. Once manifest, Sandra determined the story that is being told, and Terence, she revealed, was at the core. At that moment in Joshua Tree, I didn't know anything about Sandra, except her name, her profession, but not what followed from that. It was a terrain unknown and completely mystifying. I knew less about Terence Green. The process of writing a novel seems simple, but it isn't. Write a character into a story, press save, he or she exists. Highlight his or her name and the surrounding paragraph. Press the scissor icon on the toolbar. One or the other or both die. Then press save to ensure the demise. Theoretically, Terence Green can be entirely disappeared from the text. I could paste the words that describe him into a file labeled outtakes, and he would only exist in limbo, waiting to know if he will ever have a real life. That possibility is only theoretical. Sandra appeared, and then Terence appeared. I had great trepidation about writing about him. I didn't know if I have the right to write about a Native man, inasmuch as cultural appropriation is an ongoing violation, but I didn't have the right to refuse him either. Finally, I have to accept what negative consequences might come to me from my limitations and hope to have the skill to record his true self, to honor and respect him as is his due. I had to yield to him. He wanted to live. Sandra insisted, and then he insisted. He asserted that the text cannot exist without him. He carries wisdom. When Terence came forth, Hastin Seda began to speak more forthrightly. He is an elder and certainly a wisdom keeper. The time for this wisdom has come. They will not be erased. So in this original moment from which the book emerges, I realized I had to yield. And that's, in a sense, what I'm saying to the culture from which I emerge. We have to yield. There is a wisdom we did not recognize, and we must yield to it. And one of the ways we do it is what you were talking about, which is listening. And we have to be willing to give up the structures of our institutions, the way we think about things, and our certainties, and see what we might be able to hear that will allow the restoration of life. So, I'm sorry is a phrase that goes through the book. And the writer said at the beginning, we don't hear from her again. She yields, and the story emerges, and these characters come to life. And they're extraordinary. And they are suffering. And part of the book is that we have to learn and experience their suffering. Because their suffering is about what's happening on the earth. It's completely heartbreaking. And yet, they come together. And yet, all my relations becomes real. And it's not a fairy tale. And it's not easy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, it's just that's just beautiful. We've just heard Dina Metzger reading from A Rain of Nightbirds, the beginning, the preface to her new novel. Where can people find the book, Dina? By going to your website?
Yes, they can go to my website. Of course, you can always buy it in from Amazon. But you can also buy it from Birch Bark Books and Native Arts in Minneapolis. So if you go online to Birch Bark Books, you can get it. If we can wait 1 second, I hope you can.
We're going to be, as Dina's looking for the URL, I'm just going to say that we're going to be wrapping up the show soon. And it's just been an extraordinary, beautiful conversation with writer, poet, ecologist, counselor, healer, convener of circles, Dina Metzger, talking about her book, A Rain of Nightbirds. Just published, just about a week ago, a little more than a week ago.
Well, April 22nd, actually, on Earth Day.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Allison, I'm sorry.
Well, Birch Bark Books, is that right? Oh, I've got it here. Birchbarkbooks.com. BIRCHBARK Books.com. And then look for A Rain of Nightbirds, and that is the site of the publisher. You can buy it directly from them, from Dina's website, if you'd like to read more about her work, learn more about her work, dinametzger.net. Metzger, Dina is D-E-E-N-A, Metzger, M-E-T-Z-G-E-R.net. And there's a lot of richness in her other writing and other activities and councils and events that she's involved with on her website as well. It's just been really, really wonderful and so touching and timely and true and so resonating in so many ways to have you here on Connect the Dots, Dina. Thank you so much. This book is a great gift, and as is all your work, as you are. And thank you.
And thank you, Allison, for the gift of your work and hosting this and everything else you do.
Thank you, listeners. Bless you. Thank you for being with us on today's Connect the Dots. And, you know, it's interesting. I've been, we'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern time. And every week I sign off in different ways. And I think I'm going to alter our sign up, which has been keep marching forwards, you know, chin up and keep marching forward has been one I've been using since the election. But I think, you know, I think stand firm, stand where you are. You know, or Dina, if you have any refinement on that, I think we need a new slogan there for the end of the show.
Let us stand with all our relations.
Stand with all our relations.
Well, well, well.